You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I am speaking with Dr. Paul Sansari. Dr. Sansari is a psychologist, has been a clinical psychologist for over 40 years, and has recently written a book called Gentle Parenting Reimagined. Actually, the full title is, let me get it to you, Gentle Parenting Reimagined, How to Make It Work with Oppositional and Defiant Kids. Dr. Sansari's book is very practically laid out. It's actually organized around what are the issues. You know, if you have an issue with homework, if you have an issue with screen time, if you have an issue with X, Y, Z, being kind or not kind to one's siblings, there's a chapter on that. And this book grows out of 40 plus years of working with families with highly oppositional children and young adults. But it's not entire, it's not just for that. So the techniques really shed light on how any parents can improve the relationship with their child and in turn, create a happier, healthier, more positive young person. So I had a wonderful conversation with Dr. Sansari, and I hope you enjoy.
Hello there, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. And as I said in my introduction, I am speaking with Dr. Paul Sansari. Do I have that name spoken correctly?
Yes, that's exactly correct. Thank you.
Dr. Sansari, well, from now on, I will call him Paul.
Yes,
Paul
please.
Has been a psychologist, clinical psychologist for 40 years, 40 plus years, working with a variety of people, but a lot with young people and families, and we'll be talking about that today, and especially families, especially young people with. Well, how would you say it?
Well, so the kids that I work with and the families that I work with are kids who have just very serious mental health conditions. So this could be anything from self-harm, suicide, to highly oppositional behavior. We also work, really since the pandemic, with a lot of kids who have a lot of school avoidance. So they don't go to school because they're too anxious. Mm-hmm. Some of them haven't been in school in quite some time.
And for Dr. Sansari, no, there I go again. I'm looking at the thing. But Paul has written a book, we had published it recently, that is Gentle Parenting Reimagined. And the full title, Gentle Parenting Reimagined, How to Make It Work with Oppositional and Defiant Kids. So before we dig into the oppositional and defiant kids, what is gentle parenting? Briefly, what is gentle parenting? And why does it need to be reimagined?
So gentle parenting, I'll start with that. So the idea has been around for about 10 years or so, and lots of folks have heard about it. It's more or less in the mainstream now. I'll give you an overview of what it is. So it's mostly about having the best possible relationship with your kid that you can. So it's about emphasizing connection, attachment. It's about leaning into kids so that you have an understanding of their emotional lives. And unlike other styles of parenting, maybe from previous generations, there's less of an emphasis on punishment when kids behave in a way that you don't care for, and more of an emphasis on trying to understand the root causes of the behavior and working with that child or teen in a more collaborative way to solve the problem. So that's the basic idea behind it. And I think most parents like the idea of being gentle. I don't know who wouldn't necessarily. But where it goes wrong and why I wrote the book is I don't think gentle parenting in its traditional form works particularly well with kids who are more oppositional. So these are kids who probably have some sort of biological or temperamental difference that makes them far more often to say no, to challenge their parents' authority, to then behave in ways that are fairly off-putting. So they can be disrespectful, they can yell at their parents. Many of them will throw pretty severe temper tantrums. Some of them destroy property. Just really all the big stuff that makes it very difficult for parents to navigate their daily lives. So gentle parenting, because of its emphasis on leaning in and understanding, I think sometimes that approach with kids who are highly oppositional, or at least every kid I've ever worked with over the last 40 years, that backfires in some pretty big ways. So I really wrote this book for folks who want to have a gentle style, but are struggling with a child or teen that is just far more difficult to parent than the average kid.
So just so I can get a sense of the target audience, could somebody who is just interested, I mean, is this book primarily focused on the highly oppositional child? Or could somebody who just wants to, is sort of tired of the tug and war, tired of the sort of bashing heads, ramming into each other, can get something out of, even if their kids are not necessarily extremely oppositional, but just normal teenagers, which maybe that's redundant, but you know what I mean?
Well, absolutely. So the kids that I talk about in the book and the various different strategies and interventions that I propose, they can be applied to kids who are extremely difficult, and just as easily to kids who have problems maybe with certain things, but not everything. So an example of that would be a kid who struggles with doing their homework. You know, maybe they're not oppositional in any other aspect of their life. But doing homework with them is a battle. They don't want to do it. They don't want to start. A lot of teenagers have accumulated a huge number of missing assignments. So they don't do the homework and they don't turn it in. But maybe everywhere else in their life, the kid's doing just fine. There's a chapter in the book on just about every big thing that I can think of that typically goes wrong in families. So as I said, there's a chapter on homework, on chores, on being respectful. There's a chapter on screen time. First, I talk about what are the negative effects of screen time on kids? How does it impact their mental health? And then I move from that to teaching parents strategies and interventions to reduce screen time in their own homes. So if you have a kid that's glued to their phone for 6 or 7 hours a day and you ask them to put it down, and that results in, you know, maybe some resistance or at worst, a major eruption of some kind, I walk parents through the strategies to reduce that in a safe way to get over that resistance. So it's really everything that I could possibly think of, but you can think of it as a menu. You open up the menu and you say, I want this. And that's the chapter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could, as soon as you said screen time, I think I could hear the purchasing of your book. That battle. When I was working at a school, that battle was constant, and watching the battle between parents and kids, and I must say, it was not always clear to me that the kids were the culprit, because the parents were constantly texting their kids as well. So there is that.
That I recommend to parents is instituting what I call family time. And family time is about an hour and a half, Monday through Friday, typically around dinner time. So family time might begin around 6 and ends maybe around 7:30. And then on the weekends, family time is much longer. It's about 4 hours on Saturday and 4 hours on Sunday. What is it? It's a time period where nobody in the family is on a screen, not parents, not kids. And so when family time begins, everybody sets their devices up on the kitchen counter and they don't go back on again, or they're not given back to the kids until family time ends. Well, what happens during family time? Well, once a kid no longer has access to a device, they're far more motivated to come out of their bedrooms and start interacting with people just simply looking for something to do. And one of the exceptions to family time is families can watch a movie. So there is that screen that is enabled.
Got it.
And it works great. So the kids, again, wander out of their bedrooms, usually want to spend time with their families. They don't have to. It can just be a way to reduce screen time. The other cool thing about family time is you also don't give kids back their devices or re-enable them until they've done whatever else it is that you want them to do that sometimes is a sticking point. So if you have a kid who has a hard time getting their chores done, you can say, well, you know, probably be great for you to get your chore done before family time comes to an end. But if you don't, you could do that now. And I would be happy to let you pick up your phone after you've done your chore. So it's a great way to establish a daily habit of getting the chore done by a certain time. Homework is the same way, which is probably good for you to do your homework before family comes to an end. But if you don't, feel free to do your homework at 7:30. And I would be happy to re-enable your screens or give them back to you once your homework is completed. So you kill several birds with one stone.
So family time is not, well, screw it, I'm just going to go do my homework instead. I have to be with the family.
No, it's not at all about that. You don't in any way try to regulate or manage what the kid does during family time. And
so
for
it's
me,
just non-screen time, yeah.
Screen time. And for me, if a kid said, well, I'm not going to watch a movie with you, I'm going to go do my homework, that's cause for celebration. It's like, man, what a responsible kid that is. I would just love it if a kid said that to his parents. No, you don't try to force togetherness. You just force no screens. But that naturally produces more togetherness. Now, one quick caveat about family time is, parents are probably already thinking this as I'm speaking about it. Well, what if they won't give their phone up? What if that turns into a battle or a conflict of some kind? And this is what I've learned about starting family time is that no kid likes it. Every kid that you try to introduce family time to is going to say, that's dumb, that's stupid. You can't take away my phone. Don't you understand that my phone is what makes me less depressed? Or that's how I talk to my friends. Everybody resists family time at the beginning. But once you stand your ground and just push through that, usually within a week or two, the kids are generally on board with the idea. I also wouldn't give a phone back to a kid who just gripes for the hour and a half during family time. That's not how this works. The way it works is everybody puts their screen up, but it's not about you complaining for the next hour and a half. And if you do, I'm very unlikely to give you your phone back then. And for kids who will not put their phones up on the counter or refuses to give them up altogether, there's several strategies in the book on how to get a kid to give up their devices without it turning into a massive conflict. For example, you can remotely disable just about any device. There are strategies, and you don't have to take the device away from the kid. You can install various versions of a kill switch that makes it not of any value to them. So that takes parents out of the situation of having to say, hand me your phone, and the kid says, I'm not going to give it to you. So you just turn it off. That tends to work pretty well.
But I would imagine it is a challenge for some parents to be clear about what those rules are and then to stick with them, right? Set something up and here's a boundary, here's a whatever. And despite all of the complaining and all of the resistance, no, that's where it is. So that's got to be a challenge for a lot of parents who are used to the battle and not used to simply setting up the line. So could you talk about that and what role, for lack of a better term, or maybe that is the term, what role boundaries play in gentle parenting? And is there some trick to being firm and yet still being gentle?
Well, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. So first of all, I've never met a kid that misbehaves every minute of every day. That kid may exist, but I've never come across them. In truth, even the hardest kids I've ever worked with still go through fairly large portions of their day doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. So you can be gentle during those spaces. And when I say gentle, I mean you're kind, you're loving, you're attentive. I use a lot of humor with kids, both with the ones that I work with and with my four daughters. I think humor is a great way to connect with somebody. And if you can make somebody laugh, it's hard for that person to feel miserable at the same time. It's just a really easy thing to do. So if your default is gentle, if your standard operating procedure is to be soft, loving, and kind, there's a lot of space in every day, even with super hard kids, to be that. However, if they start to push back or, become disrespectful or maybe even tell you to F off or something like that, or refuse to help out, or they start to mistreat their siblings, you can still intervene on those behaviors in a gentle way. It just means that you don't raise your voice. And I feel very strongly about this, that there's never a reason to raise your voice with kids. So if I'm working with a kid and they're doing something I don't care for, I won't raise my voice with them, but I will shift my voice in a direction where it's clear that I want something from them. So I say, look, I'm not happy with your behavior right now, and it's not okay for you to talk to me that way. So either dial it back and be more respectful, please. And if you can't do that, I'm going to go ahead and turn off your devices until you've been respectful to me for a while, right? So I'm not yelling. I'm not mad. I am pretty matter of fact as I'm saying those things. So the thing about parents who raise their voice and start yelling is the honest truth about that is sometimes it works, right? If you ask nicely 10 times and the kid still doesn't do the thing you want to do out of frustration or irritation, the parent is going to say, get to it right now, right? And sometimes kids will then comply because either they don't like being yelled at or they think the parent is serious at that point. But you don't want kids to listen for your angry yelling voice. You want them to listen to the reasonable matter of fact one. So that's why staying matter of fact is always the way to go. Your question was, is it hard for parents to be firm? I think for most of the parents that I work with, they do just fine making their expectations clear. You need to take out the trash, or you got to get your homework done, or you can't tell me to F off, for example. That's a setting a limit. This is not okay. Most of them do just fine with that. The problem that where it goes wrong is, well, how do you enforce the limit? So if you tell a kid that you got to get your homework done, how do you enforce that expectation when they simply refuse to do it? So parents of highly oppositional kids, most of the time, they're not softies. They're not permissive parents, but they explain to the kid until they're blue in the face why they should be doing their homework and the value of getting a high school diploma and all those things that a lot of kids don't care about. How do you actually enforce the expectation? And that's what the book is about. I know how to get kids to do their homework, right? It's not rocket science to me, only because I've been helping kids do their homework for the last 40 years. But it's a skill set that most parents don't have, right? They've never been taught these things. So they're winging it as they go with the kid that is a lot harder than what they expected. And in cases where they're siblings, usually the siblings are a lot easier to parent. These are kids who will do their homework or will take out the trash and are probably respectful much of the time. It's the more difficult to parent child that throws parents off because they don't know what to do. That's, again, why I wrote the book is, I can get kids to do the various different things. I know how to get a kid up in the morning to an alarm clock. So parents don't have to be the alarm clock. They don't have to go in and wake up an irritable kid 10 times who tells them to leave me alone, right? How to get them up to an alarm clock, how to be self-sufficient in the morning so they don't need tons of prodding. Did you brush your teeth? Now it's time to put your shoes on and out the door on time so that they get to school on time. Only because I've, again, worked with many, many kids who have a hard time getting up in the morning. I just teach parents strategies that work and let go of any strategies they might be using that aren't working or making the situation worse.
So you said, I think I got this right. You said a little earlier that gentle parenting has been around for 10-ish years. You said also that you have four daughters. And
I'm
assuming that are they younger than 10?
No.
No. So
they're all in their 20s.
How are you parenting? How were you parenting before there was gentle parenting?
Well, I think I was naturally always a gentle parent.
Really?
I worked directly with kids for so long. I think I sort of naturally fell into a style where You know, I was a pretty loving, kind dad, I think, for the vast majority of the time. And only because I had worked with hard kids for so long, I'd kind of already figured out what was effective. I also learned very early on with those kids, not mine, but the ones I had worked with, that raising my voice never worked with them. So if I'm dealing with a kid who's throwing a chair at me, the last thing I should be doing is yelling at them to put the chair down. And it was obvious that that didn't work. It always made the behavior bigger. And so I kind of fell into the habit of just never raising my voice with kids, but also knowing what to do to make sure that kid doesn't throw a chair at me again. Ours is psychologists figured this out, or at least some psychologists have figured this out. Teachers don't raise their voice with their students. They don't get so mad that they yell at their students, or at least hopefully they the professionals don't raise their voice when somebody is doing something. And the other thing that made it easy with my own daughters is I just had four easy to parent kids. I just was totally locked out on this.
Well, that's not fair.
No, it's not fair. Maybe if we'd had a fifth, that kid would have been off the rails. I have no idea. But no, they did their homework. They did their chores. They'd forget to do chores sometimes. But if I just said, hey, would you mind doing it now? They'd get right up and they'd do it. They were just such joys. We had a couple problems here and there, but nothing like what the parents that I work with encounter every day.
I'm not sure it's the right word, but what's the most challenging thing for parents if they want to, if they realize that, you know, the way they have been with their child is sort of oriented towards punishment and being sort of drill sergeant, and they want to make a change, what's the biggest challenge for them? Is there a mistake that parents have, you know, have a hard time not making?
Tons of mistakes. And I can just give you a list if you want.
A mistake that really sort of, you know, there's this is where they're going to screw up.
Well, I'll give you a couple of examples that come to mind. The first one is many of the parents I work with prior to treatment spend way too much time trying to persuade their kids to do things. Right. They try and talk them into doing their homework or talk them into doing their chore. So that turns into these endless back and forth conversations that go nowhere. So every time the parent says, well, everybody is supposed to help out around here and your sister takes out the trash, as if somehow that's going to talk a reluctant kid into doing a chore, it never works and almost always turns into a big fight. By the end of the fight, the kid is yelling, the parents are yelling, and that kid is still not doing their chores. So I talk about letting go of persuasion. Sure, you can collaborate with kids sometimes on which chores they do, as long as they do some of them. So there is room for negotiation. But I think when a kid says, I don't want to do anything around the house, why should I? There's not a lot of collaboration that needs to take place, nor should there be any persuasion. The way it works in this family is everybody does something, and so do you. And so for you to get the privileges that you want every day, you essentially have to help out. And so screens and phones and gaming systems come after chores are completed and not before, right? So the privileges are always earned after the positive behavior has been demonstrated, exhibited. So phone time is after homework's done. Phone time is after your chores are done. Phone time is after we've had dinner together. Phone time is when you've been respectful all day long to me and to your brothers and sisters. So it's the thing that they want. You only get it if you do the things that, frankly, are not big ass of kids. Kids should be doing chores. They should be nice to their siblings. They're not outrageous requests, although kids will tell you their requests are outrageous.
Oh, yeah. None of my friends have to do this. Yeah,
exactly. You hear that all the time. So, sure. So let go persuasion, just implement interventions, strategies to motivate the kid to get the thing done, even though they don't want to do the thing. They don't have to like taking out the trash, but they need to take out the trash anyway. Who likes doing that, right? So stop having arguments about it. Just put the incentives in place and let the incentives do their job. You get your phone after you've ticked out the trash. I'm not going to argue with you about this. This is how it works, man. It's always going to be like this and always has been like this. The other thing parents do often is the way they use consequences is, and I don't want to go on too long about this because it requires a fairly big explanation, but there are ways of using consequences that work beautifully, and there are ways of working consequences that are terrible.
So to be clear, what do you mean by consequences? Right. I mean, it's just like you don't get your phone back?
Well, it's a punishment of some sort. I don't use the word punishment because in psychology, punishment has a very narrow definition. But I like using the word consequence because it's more of an umbrella term. And lots of parents understand what the word consequence means. So it's a penalty of some kind. And where parents go wrong is they will often impose a penalty that is just not at all effective. So you just cursed at me. Now you're without your phone for a week. There are a number of problems with this. First of all the research on that shows it doesn't work very well. The second problem is the kid lost their phone for cursing. Yet when you say now you've lost it for a week, there's going to be another explosion that trails us. So you have two problems to deal with. One is the cursing. The second is the escalation after you deliver the penalty. Yeah. Third problem with that is once you take a kid's phone away from them for a week, it can't take it away again if they curse at you tomorrow. Right? How does that work? So that type of punishment is really, really common. And so the first thing we do is we get rid of that. And instead, what we use in the language of psychology, it's called negative reinforcement. But that's a terrible name. Nobody understands it. So I've rebranded it pause, earn, and return. And what that means is if a kid engages in some negative behavior, again, let's say they curse at you, you pause their privileges. Devices are now off the table. Devices are now unavailable to you. They are paused. The only way to get your devices back is you're going to have to earn them. How do you do that? You engage in the positive behavior. So that's no cursing at me for a while. No hitting your sister for a while, you know, getting your chores done consistently for a while. So you have to exhibit the positive behaviors for a while. And that way you then return the privileges to the kid. And when I say for a while, there is no set time period, right? It's not for a week. It's not for 2 days. It's nothing like that. It's till you've earned them back. And when you say that to a kid, every kid says, well, for how long? Honest answer to that is I don't know, because it all depends on several different things. A, are you going to accept the consequence starting now? Right? Accepting the consequence is definitely a step in the right direction of earning your privileges back. And I don't know how well you're going to do today or tomorrow or the next day. Like, how nice are you going to be to me? I mean, you could wow me, you can impress me and just be over the top sweet to me, which would be helpful if you want your stuff back sooner. You could be really kind to your sister for the next couple of days. You can get your chores done without me reminding you. All of these things work in your favor. So you could do these things and probably get it back fairly quickly from me. And in my mind, quickly is either by the end of that day or maybe by the next day, right? It's not a long penalty by any stretch of the imagination.
What's the goal other than getting the sort of behavior? Like, how is this? It's certainly helping the family culture. And how is there something that this is doing that is helping the child, the child to whom it's directed? And what is that?
Absolutely. It benefits the child. And here's how. Sometimes I hear people say, well, you know, behavioral interventions don't really work in the long run. You're just kind of suppressing behavior. That doesn't really do anything for you. And that argument is nonsense. And here's why. Because kids don't like acting like this. They know it's wrong to curse at their parents. They know they should be doing their homework. They know that the expectations within the family are reasonable ones. So when kids act out day after day after day, that has a very negative effect on their mental health, their well-being. Those are angry, miserable kids who don't know why they do what they do, but they know it's an awful way to behave towards other people. So kid is miserable. Parents are miserable. Everybody's miserable. So once you start changing behavior, once you start implementing strategies to elicit consistently better behavior, it takes a while. It takes several months actually to implement all of this stuff before you start seeing changes. But once the changes occur and the kid then behaves better and better and better for longer and longer periods of time, that kid is transformed, right? That's a kid now who's doing all the things. The kid will have a better relationship with family, because how can you be close and loving to a kid that's telling you where to go? It's very hard to do. So there's a lot of disconnection in those families. But once you get a kid to start behaving in a positive way consistently, they become that kid. They become that person. And kids are not happy when they're acting out. But once everything's going smoothly, they're getting things done, they feel good about being caught up on their homework and doing their chores, they're nice to everybody again. That then means people are going to be a lot nicer to them. Families become a lot closer. Attachments become a lot stronger. And that is a kid who is well adjusted psychologically. So there's this myth that kids have to feel better to do better, right? You have to work with the kids' feelings and therapy to help them not feel so crummy about the world or be less depressed or whatever. And then once they feel better, they're going to be less oppositional or suicidal or all those things. That is not true. It's a misconception. You got to get a kid to start doing better. Start with doing better. And once kids do better for a long enough period of time, they feel better. I've worked with so many depressed and suicidal kids. They are just miserable and unhappy. They hurt themselves. They stay in darkened bedrooms and refuse to come out. That is a recipe for depression for a miserable kid. But you can incentivize those kids using the very same principles we've been talking about today to come out of their bedroom, get off a screen, start interacting with people, to be social, to get some exercise. And once those kids are doing all of those things and you incentivize them not to hurt themselves, that kid is no longer a depressed kid. That's a kid who is like anybody else. You move them out of this dark phase by not having endless conversations about how they're feeling, which often makes people feel worse. Is you start to reorganize the environment, you re-engineer the environment so they get out of that bedroom, get off their phone, start doing things, and that's a kid who's not depressed or suicidal anymore.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is contrary to a lot of the stuff that one hears about, you know, sort of exploring. And actually, it's probably a misconception, because I've been out of the parenting loop for long enough that I didn't even hear the term gentle parenting. And when I've, since our first conversation, when I've asked people about it, their take is that, oh, it's all about paying attention to the kids' feelings and, you know, sort of exploring their feelings and helping them with their feelings. And it's not that that's wrong, but the perception is that it's through conversations about feelings rather than through the sort of introducing and coaxing desirable behavior, both desirable obviously to the parent, but also to the kid, right? I mean, it's, you know, because it probably does. It feels good to have positive interactions with people. Feels better it may not feel better at first, but it feels better to exercise, to get, you know, go for a walk, to get the thank you for taking out the garbage, you know, it does. So it is their feelings, but that's it's interesting. I think that's a misconception on the part of a bunch of people who have heard about gentle parenting. It's
interesting. I was going to say, with hard kids, solely focusing on how they feel about everything does nothing to help that kid be a different version of themselves. And again, just like persuasion, you can talk to a kid about their feelings endlessly. It doesn't get them to do their homework or to be kind.
Right. Exactly. Right. 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 Yeah.
If I can share sort of an adult version of this,
absolutely,
is just bonkers. So say you're in a relationship with somebody and that person has a temper. And they, when they encounter some sort of frustration, a messy house, or the dog that keeps barking, or a spouse that asks them to maybe help out more around the house, they fly into a rage, they curse at their partner, They get physically intimidating, get up in their face. You know, they yell and scream and carry on. I cannot imagine any person standing there and trying to understand this person's feelings. It doesn't make any sense, right? If you are being threatened and intimidated and you are routinely the punching bag for somebody who has issues managing their anger, it's always going to start with limit setting. You may not speak to me that way. Now, you can be frustrated that the house is messy. You can have a bad day at work, but I am not here to be your punching bag. And this thing you do when you get angry, where you yell and scream and interrupt and get in my face, that is intolerable. And I will not be in a relationship with somebody who does that. So with an adult, you would never say, well, I see you're really angry right now and tell me what's going on. Is there a better way you could express this? No. Than it's just ridiculous, right? But for some reason with kids, although we know that approach is nuts with an adult, we try to advocate that response with them. And with kids, it always begins with limit setting too, right? This is not okay. And this will never be okay for you to kick me or hit me or spit at me or any of these terrible things. It always starts with no. And then, as I said earlier, you have to know how to enforce the no. With an adult, you can always get out of that relationship, right? I will not be mistreated. This is dysfunctional. I'm done. You can't get out of a relationship with your kids, right? You've got 18 years of being with them. Yeah. So you still do not tolerate that negative behavior. But what parents don't know is how to stop it, right? They simply don't have the knowledge base on how to get a kid out of your face to not kick you or to hit you, to be kind to you. It's not a skill set people are born with. And so that's where they run into trouble. So yes, that's the thing about gentle parenting. And that's why people make fun of it, to be honest with you, because it is kind of ridiculous sometimes. It's a good idea taken to such an extreme that anybody with some common sense would realize that you still have to set limits with your kids and you have to make sure you follow through on those limits. Mm-hmm. So it's not in no way about focusing on a kid's feelings. You see, what I say to kids is, look, you can have whatever feeling you want. You can be mad, you can be frustrated, you can be whatever. But that doesn't mean you get to hit me or to scream at me, right? Those behaviors don't naturally trail from those emotions. There's all kinds of ways of being mad that don't involve you yelling at me or punching a hole in your wall. Kids and parents sometimes will believe that the behavior is an inevitability of the anger, that it's an anger issue. It's not an anger issue. It's what to do an angry issue, right? So kids believe if they get mad enough, well, I punched a hole in the wall because I was mad. But wait a minute, we all get mad. Part of life involves getting mad. But punching a hole in your wall, I'm not buying it. Those things do not necessarily have to go together. And it's your job to work on being mad without being physically aggressive.
I mean, there are instances where the behavior and the kid is so stubborn or so adamant about that sort of behavior, you know, where it's almost like I'm trying to say, there's got to be a no. Well, see, what about danger, right? I mean, dangerous situations where a kid won't stop doing something that is dangerous, both to other people, to him or herself, etc. How does one deal with those?
Well, let me just give an example. So let's say you have a kid that routinely throws temper tantrums. We use the word temper tantrum to describe little kids. Teenagers, the word now that's come into vogue is dysregulated, but they're basically the same thing. A tantrum is a tantrum. Let's say you have a kid who's so mad. Now they're kicking a hole in the wall. They're running around the house. They're screaming at everybody. Maybe they're getting up in their parents' face, or maybe they've already hit their parents. I mean, that's a big deal, right, when those things happen. When it's a little kid, it tends to be somewhat less scary for parents because a five-year-old kicking you is generally not that big of a deal. You outweigh them by 100 pounds easily.
Right.
But with a teenager doing those same things, that is a big deal. There are a lot of bad habits that people fall into when they have a kid who's behaving like that. Usually what they do is they stay fully engaged with the kid. Stop that. Don't do that. Take some deep breaths. It's not okay for you to do that. Or the parent will get super upset too, which is, I told you to stop doing that. You can't do that. You're going to lose your phone for a month if you keep doing this. So they stay engaged. It's a constant back and forth exchange that takes place between the parent and the kid. And the problem with that is it actually keeps the kids, I'll use the word dysregulation, alive. That's what keeps the kid in that upset, angry, dysregulated state. There are a lot of influencers on TikTok who say when your kid is throwing a tantrum, is you talk to them and soothe them and ask them what's going on and why don't you do this, which is completely the opposite of what all of the research says on what to do with a kid who's tantruming. What the research says is you disengage. And you refuse to interact with that child or have a conversation with them until they're fully calmed down and back under control. And what you say to them is, I will not have a conversation with you when you're yelling at me. Or I can't talk to you about this or anything else while you're speaking to me this way. You say it, then you walk away from the kid, you turn your back on them and walk away. You've disengaged. Disengagement is a vital step in getting kids to stop throwing tantrums, stop being dysregulated, because what you're teaching them is you only get my attention when you're calm, and you will never get my attention when you're doing this thing that you're doing right now, right? And you walk away from them. If they follow you, you go to a bedroom or a bathroom, you close and lock the door. We've had some parents just go for a walk. Some parents get in the car and actually leave the house, but you refuse to energize or engage that kid when they're being that angry and aggressive, right? And you only shift your attention back to them once they fully calm down. And for most kids, fully calming down takes about an hour, two or three, somewhere in that vicinity, but it's never 5 minutes. That's way too soon. So you disengage. So we lay the foundation of disengagement for these families. And then the next thing we do is we come up with reasonable penalties for tantrums. And certainly for property damage or physical aggression, those are big ticket items in my mind. Yeah, like that's pretty egregious behavior. So yeah. When you are aggressive or when you kick a hole in the wall, the penalty is going to be steeper than you cursing at me. And so that would still involve device restrictions, privilege restrictions, but for a longer period of time. So the kid is going to have to go longer before they can earn back their privileges for engaging in an egregious behavior. How much is longer? In the vicinity probably of a week, never longer than that. And that week, it's a week of them giving you all the good things, all the behaviors that you want. And if one day is bad and maybe they get upset about something on day three, I wouldn't even say anything about that. I might wait until the next time they say, can I have my phone back? And what I would say to that is, how am I going to do that? You're on Wednesday, you lost your temper again. So you're still working on earning it back. You can go day by day with me. So does that kind of help? Because when you get the really big things, you have to stay disengaged.
Yeah, it's hard only because you can, I'm just imagining all sorts of, having lived through, when the kid takes the keys and takes the car. I've disengaged, but the kid takes the car and goes, well, wait, it's not even his car. Hold on. Right. I mean, then it's, you know, the temptation is I'm going to call the cops and say my car's been taken by my child.
Well, your example is a little bit different because the kid is not throwing a temper tantrum. That's a kid who's breaking a rule in a pretty serious way. So in that instance, I don't advocate disengagement. I advocate for real world penalties for that. I would call the police and
okay. Cars. And let
him interact with law enforcement, right? Or maybe law enforcement doesn't care that this kid is out driving around because it's not a big thing to them. But the kid's eventually going to come home with the car. And the penalty for that is massive, right? You took the car without permission. You're driving illegally. You're doing all the things that you know is not okay. That kid is not going to be seeing that car for some period of time or seeing any of their privileges for that time. It would be privilege restriction. The better word for it is grounding. No friends, no nothing, no fun. This is going to be a while.
I mean, you know, and I don't want to be nitpicky about this, but I mean, it's hard not to call that punishment.
Well, I would call that punishment. I'm not saying you can't ever use punishment. I'm just saying that in general, pause, earn, and return is the preferred default. But there are some behaviors that absolutely lend themselves to the more traditional, you're in the doghouse and you're going to stay there.
Right.
The taking a car without permission is a great example of that.
Right. Well, I like the pause, earn, and return nomenclature because it lays out a path.
Yeah.
For the kid, which is really what's missing with, you know, with a lot of punishments, it's just a penalty. And
pause and return. You're eliciting. You're squeezing out the behavior that you want. And again, you're super firm on this. You will not get your screens back or see your friends until you're doing the things that you know you need to be doing, which is going to school, getting your homework done, being nice, all the stuff that you would expect of any kid in any family. And you're relentless. I will not give your stuff back until you give me this. And every kid eventually does it. Every kid, if you apply that strategy that I've ever worked with, will eventually engage in the positive behavior. And it's the application of pause, earn, and return, and sometimes disengagement over and over and over and over again that changes the behavior gradually over time. These things don't change behavior in 24 hours. You're going to have to apply this. But I cannot think of hardly any situations in the last 40 years where parents have done this and not ultimately gotten things to a vastly better place in their family if you just stick with it.
Well, and I want to underline that point again, is that it is not just in their family, it's in that young person, right, in that child, because now they're in a much more positively oriented family, and that feels better. So,
well, it becomes a feedback loop. So the kid behaves better. Parents then aren't as stressed or as angry. Kid notices that. That fuels more positive behavior, because who doesn't want their parents to love them and to feel good about them? That downregulates negative behavior. Parents feel even better, and so on and so on and so on. So it just starts to build on itself organically once the interventions are in place.
Yeah. Well, Paul, what else is there to be said before we, because I know we have limited time, but what would be, if we stopped now, what would you hit your head about and say, oh my God, we should have talked about blah, blah, blah.
That's a great question. So first of all, there are many, many families in this situation. In fact, I'm part of a couple of Facebook groups for parents of kids who are oppositional. One of them has 37,000 members. So there's a huge population of families out there who are struggling with all of the issues we've been talking about today. And most of them have hit a dead end, right? So they've tried medication that hasn't helped. They've tried individual therapy that hasn't helped. And they're still in a war zone every single day with their kids. The messages that the parents post they're just heartbreaking. And to live in that kind of a world where they dread waking up in the morning because they have no idea what their kid is going to do for them that day. The message I want to send is to those parents is you do not have to live like this. Mm. These are all changeable circumstances, but nobody ever tells them how to do it, because your average therapist doesn't know how to do this. You know, your average psychiatrist knows about medication, but not about behavior change. And so if you're one of those families listening to this podcast, there is hope and lots of opportunities for positive change. You know, if you don't find those solutions in my book, or you find they're too difficult for you to implement, then find a therapist who can help you and support you implement those strategies. You're going to have to look for a while to find one, but don't just send your kid to individual therapy, because it doesn't work. It's not effective with kids who are oppositional. And don't think that medication is going to solve your problems, because in 40 years of my doing this, and this is not an exaggeration, I cannot think of one time with an oppositional kid who was placed on a medication where there was any noticeable difference whatsoever in their behavior. Not one single time. And I'm not saying it hasn't helped some parents with some of their kids. I've just never encountered it. Well, so it tells me the odds of it helping are low.
So I'm assuming, so can people join this Facebook group? And would you provide that information so I could put it on in the notes?
Yes, they all have similar names. So if you go to Facebook and you search groups, it would be Parents of Oppositional and Defiant Kids.
Right. And I'll make sure that that's in the notes, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah. Also, I will make sure that both the cover of your book is shown, and I'm assuming it can be had Amazon. Where can somebody buy it? Where can somebody find it?
Everywhere books are sold. So anywhere.
Okay. That's great. That's great. And you live in Northern California, and that's where you do your work. Do you also do work online? If somebody from, you know, Sheboygan is listening to this, is there a way for them to reach out to you?
The first thing I do is Google Sheboygan, because I have no idea what that is.
Sheboygan, Wisconsin.
Oh, all right. Well, there we go. So I'm the developer of something called intensive family focused therapy. It's a family-based model of mental health care for kids who are highly oppositional, chronically suicidal, or so anxious that they have checked out of life. So the way the laws of psychology work is I can only work with people in the state in which I am licensed. So I and my colleagues, because this is a team model, we're all licensed in California. So any California family listening to this, we would be happy to work with you. If you're not in our local area, we would do our sessions by Zoom. And those are just as effective as doing sessions in person. If it's anywhere outside of California, by law, I can't help them. I'm always happy to talk with parents. I'm always happy to give feedback or make suggestions or advice. So I'm not officially doing therapy with you, but I'd be happy to at least point you in the right direction, someplace in your state that may be able to assist.
I was about to say, is there some sort of a network of, whether it's a formal one or informal, of folks who do this sort of work well, and they happen to be working in Sheboygan? I mean, right? Might there be a no? There isn't. No,
and I wish there was. Maybe someday there will be. But no, there are not a lot of us doing this version of what I've been describing today. There are other family-based models of mental health care that are well established with great clinical outcomes. That would be something like functional family therapy, systemic therapy. And those are, you can Google those. And those are more readily available in the U.S., but they're not everywhere all the time. Mm-hmm. But I know I wish there was a network. But again, I can tell parents what to look for. I can give them some ways of doing searches where maybe potentially the right people will pop up that they can reach out to.
Got it. Well, Paul Cinceri, thank you. Dr. Paul Cinceri and Paul, thank you. Thank you for spending this time. My parenting days, no, take that back. My parenting days are not over, but my days of challenge with my with the people I was parenting are long gone. But my God, if I could go back and do some of that. Yeah. So thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm sure others will as well.
And thank you so much for having me on, David. I appreciate being here. And you've asked a number of really thought-provoking questions, which makes the conversation with me that much more enjoyable. So thank you so much for doing that.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.